Welcome to the new State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkind.
I'm Joseph Pache.
And I'm Grace Wan. This is your weekly conversation about where we live.
And what matters most. We are live.
And we are local.
Every Monday night.
Right here on KALW.
Welcome to State of the Bay. I'm Grace Wan. My co-hosts Joseph Pache and Ethan Elkind are off for the night, but you'll hear Ethan later this hour interviewing Emily Bernstein about the Instagram account Overheard in San Francisco. That features all the weird and wonderful snippets of conversation you hear while you're strolling down 24th Street, or you're in line for coffee, or you're waiting for the 38 Geary. And tonight, I'll be talking to Bay Area author Julie King about her new book, How to Talk When Kids Won't Listen, Whining, Fighting, Meltdowns, Defiance, and Other Challenges of Childhood. So be ready to fire up the phones with your parenting questions. But first, let's talk about trash. During the pandemic, more people were out on the streets exercising and getting fresh air. And sadly, that also meant more trash on the streets. Thankfully, inner Richmond resident Vincent Nguyen decided to take matters into his own hand. And in March last year, he created Refuse Refuse, a group that organizes volunteer trash cleanup opportunities, provides educational workshops for schools and neighborhood groups, and works on policy change. Vincent Nguyen is here with us tonight. Welcome to State of the Bay, Vincent.
Hi. Thanks for having me, Grace. Appreciate it.
Well, we are delighted to have you, and I want to say thank you for keeping the city streets a little bit cleaner.
Well, it's not just me. It's a crew of people out there, some professionals, some volunteers, but we're all in it together. So, again, I appreciate you give me the opportunity to share this message and hopefully get a few more people to join our crew.
Well, tell me, where did the idea for Refuse Refuse come from?
Well, it came from when, kind of back in when I was walking my kids when they were younger in our neighborhood in the inner Richmond to school with another neighbor, stepping over trash. There's tornadoes of trash just spinning around. I'm just like, they can't be this way. We would always talk about, we should, clean this up sometime. Of course, we never did. And then during the pandemic, as Julie King can attest to, the kids going crazy. We're just trying to figure out things to get outside to do. They're bored of gardening and bike riding and hiking. So thinking of something outdoors, socially distanced, I just went online, bought a couple pickers, and we just started going out, cleaning up the street. My daughter's 7 and 5, maybe spent about a half hour a day just cleaning our street up and down. And it worked. Our street was noticeably cleaner. We were able to get further out into the neighborhood in that same time. And one day, my neighbor Brennan, who new friend, he called down from his second story building and said, "Hey, what are you doing down there?" And I said, "Oh, we're just picking up trash." And he said, "I want to join you." I'm like, okay. So exchange numbers. Next week, he was out there with me. And I'm like, okay, there's something here. So I just started doing more research on how cities and municipalities keep their space clean. And so, there's a lot of research out there, a lot of interesting facts in this model of volunteers working to keep the city clean. Then I tried to adopt that, made a quick website, posted on Nextdoor, which I'd never been on before, and it kind of blew up in our own area, and people started to join, and rest is history, I guess.
Well, you are pretty famous on Nextdoor. I've actually seen the posts. I think you're the most favorite person on Nextdoor, which is hard to accomplish on Nextdoor.
Well, it's probably because it's like the only positive story on Nextdoor that I've ever
posted. That's probably right. So tell me, what does a day at Refuse Refuse look like? Like, what's cleanup like when you gather together with your neighbors?
It varies. So, what I I'm ultimately encouraging people to do is, care about enough about their neighborhood that they will go out on their own to clean their streets, self-motivated, self-activated. So working backwards to do that, we create these opportunities for people to come together in the community to clean together and kind of demonstrate their love and care for their neighborhoods. And so we're organizing with the help of our city's Department of Public Works, another nonprofit organization called Together SF, which is a large network of volunteer opportunities and civic engagement, and a number of other partners from neighborhood associations, merchants associations, different groups that partner and co-host, merchants that sponsor it. So again, like I said, it's not just me. Refuse Refuse is just kind of a banner for the collective effort to try to keep our city clean. And we have a lot of challenges as far as the filth that's in our street, and it's everywhere. It's not just the Tenderloin. It's not just Mission and Soma. It's everywhere. It's Pack Heights. It's Sunnyside. It's Richmond. So, what I'm hoping is that people see that they're empowered to make a difference, and it's very easy. The barriers to entry is low. We're trying to just create frictionless civic engagement opportunities, and this is just one way to get involved. So, you know, we love the neighborhood cleanups. That doesn't keep it clean, you know, so it's fun. People come out and we have a good time and you feel like you're part of a bigger movement. So we will always have them. But again, we got to work back to the steps of people going out, just cleaning their own block. You don't have to come to my neighborhood, just clean your own. When I come to yours, it'll be great. You come to mine, you expect a clean street and we all benefit. And that's the way you keep it clean. And that's the efficiency of just cleaning your own area.
Well, what have you learned about our city from picking up its trash? I mean, what's the most typical thing that you find? And what's the craziest piece of trash you've had to pick up?
People ask me that. I'm like, it's all trash. It's all garbage. There's nothing interesting. Funny enough, like a couple weekends ago, I've been doing this for 9 months. And I, you know, you get a quarter here and there and a dime. And I found on Saturday in my own neighborhood a $20 bill.
So oh,
God. Yeah. Sunday, I joined a cleanup on Divisadero. And same thing, I found it. So I think it's the universe telling me I'm going to write back.
I think so. I think you should go buy a lottery ticket with the $40 that you found.
Absolutely. I mean, my hourly is pretty bad, but maybe I can turn it into something else. But yeah, I mean, I guess it's just that, you know, again, the trash situation is hyper-local depending on where you are, block to block. So it really takes kind of a focus of people in the neighborhood who understand, you know, where the trash is. And the main reason for all the trash is the production and consumption of single-use materials, right? All the packaging. You think about a tube of toothpaste, right? It's toothpaste in a plastic tube that's in a cardboard box that's shrink-wrapped, that's surrounded in bubble wrap, that's in another corrugated shipping box that you ordered from Amazon or online. And so you're talking about all these materials for a single item. And we all, you know, benefit from that convenience, but the downside is that it all is this waste material that's produced. And so as we overstuff our Recology bins, which are not designed to keep that trash in there, especially when they're moving into the dump truck, it just escapes. And San Francisco is the second densest city in the country. We're one of the top 10 windiest major metropolitan cities. We're actually windier than Chicago with an average wind speed of 10.6 miles per hour. So it's like a lot of things working against us. But again, we can use that density. We can hopefully use that San Francisco progressiveness and forward thinking to have a solution, which is us going out in mass to keep it clean.
Well, tell me about your trash logs. I understand that you don't just pick up the trash, you count it.
Yeah, data is very important to us. The log is just kind of to keep track, you know, to have milestones and, you know, just the collective effort of how much we're doing. You know, there's bunch of individuals that come together to make this collective. And so we kind of use that as benchmarks. In the beginning of this campaign, we were doing a lot of what we call waste audits. We're actually tally counting the trash that's out there in the streets because we wanted to create a benchmark to understand, you know, where it is, what materials make up this trash, where it's coming from. And also as a benchmark to see, okay, if we're cleaning this area regularly, if we come back, does it make any difference? And it does. You know, for example, Masonic Avenue between Geary and Euclid in front of the Trader Joe's there. There's a Muni Depot on one side. It's the back of these houses up on the hill. So it's kind of a no man's land. And I shop there and I'm always just, just why is it so dirty here? And when we first started cleaning, we counted over 2,500 pieces of trash. Mm. We've been cleaning it weekly for about 7 months now. And now when we go back and count, it's less than 600. So you're talking about a 75% reduction. Yes, it comes back, but we keep coming back and it's a noticeable difference. And so what I'm saying is this is a proof of concept. It can occur in other places in the city very easily.
Well, I think you told our producer that one of the most common pieces of trash that you find are cigarette butts. Is that I was surprised by that because I kind of think of us as a non-smoking city. But tell me about that and what we can do to prevent cigarette butts from landing in the gutter.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's true. It's like, oh, no one smokes anymore.
And you're right.
Let's go. And then you look down, you pick up trash. You're like, oh, wow. Yes, they do. And in mass. And so about 35% of the litter by count is made up of cigarette butts.
Wow.
And about 60 to 70% of smokers don't consider that littering. And it's just social behavior. It's just habit, right? It's just like, that's what you do. You finish your cigarette and you just toss it. So what we're just trying to say is like, you know, it's everyone's right to choose to smoke if they like, but, you know, do the right thing. After that is just dispose of it properly because the cigarette butts are actually made out of plastic. There's a material called cellulose acetate that's in them. And it takes about 10 to 15 years to decompose. And when it does, it turns into microplastics. And of course, being a coastal city, we're right next to the bay. Everything that goes down those storm drains has a potential of getting into the ocean, into the water. So what we're hoping to do is education. You know, if you can get 10% of those smokers not to litter, that's a huge amount, right? That's 10% more of other trash that we could pick up if we're committed to picking up the trash by hand. And we recently developed these homemade soup can ashtrays. So you'll be seeing those in our neighborhoods because we go around picking up the trash. We know where the concentration of those cigarette butts are. And it's a nice passive way of letting people know, do the right thing. It's a nice, convenient, easy way to properly dispose of your cigarette butts. So, you know, be on the lookout for these butt cans that you'll see
around. I mean, listen up, smokers. Go find yourself a butt can. I mean, are there enough garbage cans in San Francisco? Is that part of the problem, that we don't have enough public cans? Or is it just that we're not paying attention to trash?
I'm on the fence on that. So, you know, Gavin Newsom, actually, when he was mayor, took out a lot of the public trash cans under the pretense that it does attract a lot of dumping and just, you know, people just taking the residential trash and just throwing it on there and creating these piles, which it does. But I don't think that production and consumption of trash decreased. It just found other places to get scattered. More trash cans, as long as they're be contained and you can't pull things out, it's better. If they're serviced and actually cleaned on a regular schedule, then that would make a difference. More trash cans, I guess, would provide more opportunities for people to throw away. The research shows people will walk up to 30 feet to throw something away. After that distance, it kind of explodes exponentially, the likelihood of the litter. But again, it's not really the trash can, it's human behavior. So if you take a similar dense population of Tokyo, they have virtually no public trash cans. Back in the 90s, during those sarin gas attacks, they took them out. And yet it's very, very clean in Tokyo because culturally people don't eat on public transportation. They don't eat out in public. If they do have disposable materials, they put it in their pocket and they take it home and throw it away. So again, I would say that human behavior is more of the cause than the infrastructure of having trash cans, more trash cans.
Right, right. Well, it's so nice to hear that you're out there picking up the trash. Are you with, is it kids and adults, or tell me who comes out with you?
Yeah, it's all ages. I mean, my typical gang is 65-year-old women, you know, with of a certain age of time. That's the crew I hang with. But it's also all ages. You know, we have events that families come out with young children. You know, my kids, 5 and 7, are by my side. You know, we have, it's great because it's a kind of multi-generational community building where you have students and young adults interacting with seniors and everyone in between. So it really runs the gamut. And I'm just looking to find different ways to activate and kind of reach more people and, you know, just encourage them to come out. It's for everyone, right?
Well, everybody in the studio is really enthusiastic about this project. And our board operator, David Lutchloop, wants to know, what about the highways? I mean, it's such a bummer to drive into the city and see all that trash floating around. I don't think you have little kids out in the highway picking trash, but do you have any thoughts about that?
No, I mean, that's a little bit more challenging. Caltrain does a fairly decent job as far as like what their resources are available. They do have these work programs and they get people out there. Again, the state and Gavin Newsom's administration passed a budget recently that allocated more budget towards keeping the highways clean. And you'll see them. You'll see these orange and white and blue, sometimes orange bags out on the sides. But it's just too much. I mean, people complain. They say, well, I pay high taxes. What am I getting for this money? The city should be taking care of this. But if you go out and clean up with us, you'll quickly realize there's just no feasible way that the city could do this. I mean, they'd have to employ so many people that just blow up the budget. And it's just like, so, you know, and city ordinance is that we are responsible for that space to the street from our residents or business. Mm-hmm. So technically it is our responsibility. It's just we're not taking that responsibility. Right?
Well, Vince, with the minute we have left, if our listeners wanted to join in a city cleanup day or schedule an educational program, how do they go about doing that?
Yeah, you can email us at info@refuserefusesf.org. You know, just go online, subscribe. You can email us directly. We can run these 20-30 minute presentations called SF Trash 101, where we talk about why San Francisco is so dirty, what are the solutions, how you can get involved. On our website, there's an events page where you can find upcoming cleanups in your neighborhood. And again, you know, our city has a lot of services. We have an Adopt-a-Street program you can sign up for. The city will provide tools for you to clean. And so my hope is someday that most residents in the city will have a trash picker in their possession. So there's no excuse not to go pick up that piece of scattered litter in front of your house and bring it in.
I mean, you heard it here from Vincent Yuen. He's created Refuse Refuse. Everyone go get yourself a bag and a trash picker and check out his website. It was so great to have you here on State of the Bay, Vince.
Yeah, thank you for the opportunity, Grace. I appreciate it.
Great. Coming up next on State of the Bay, we'll talk to Bay Area author and parent educator Julie King about her new book, How to Talk When Kids Won't Listen. That's right after the break. Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Grace Wan. Parenting is full of challenges. The toddler meltdown in the aisle at Target, standoffs over what's for dinner, tears over homework, defiance about chores, not to mention 2 years of a pandemic during which kids have had to stay home, attend school on Zoom, and live with stressed out adults. These are not easy times for parents or kids. To give us some guidance and sort all this out, I'm joined today by Julie King. She's the co-author of How to Talk When Kids Won't Listen: Whining, Fighting, Meltdowns, Defiance, and Other Challenges of Childhood. It's the latest book in the series How to Talk to Kids. In this most recent book, Julie and her co-author, Joanna Faber, offer up communication strategies that will help take the temperature down when things are heating up between you and your child. Welcome to State of the Bay, Julie.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, and before we dive in, I wanted to invite our listeners to join the conversation. What parenting challenges are you facing? I mean, it's 6:20 p.m. in the evening. Are you in the midst of a dinner meltdown? Is your kid on strike and not willing to take a bath? Give us a call. You can call us at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or send us a message on Twitter. We're at State of Bay. Or send us an email at stateofthebay@kalw.org. So, Julie, your book starts with an anonymous quote, and it's, "Before I became a parent, I didn't know I could ruin someone's day by asking them to put their pants on." And I love that, and I think a lot of parents relate to it. You and your co-author, Joanna Faber, whose mother actually wrote the first book in this series back in the 80s, have a bunch of communication strategies, and I wanted to talk about those first. Tell me, how can I successfully have a resolution over the "please put your pants on" scenario with an unwilling and possibly sobbing child?
Yeah, I think a lot of us can relate to that situation. our tendency is to think, if I really need my kids to put his pants on, I should tell him, put your pants on now. Stop playing and pick up the pants and put your feet in there, right? And the problem is, when we give orders to a child like that, we're creating resistance. We're creating resistance instead of creating a desire to cooperate. So if you think about for yourself, if you came home from a busy day at work and your spouse or your partner said to you, "Oh, you're home, good. Okay, hang up your coat, put your briefcase away. I need you to set the table. Did I say check your email? Put that away and come over here and get the
plates out." I don't think I could ever talk to my husband like that, but that's hilarious.
Right? That couple is in trouble.
Yes, I think so.
Marital counselors. Yeah. So we adults don't like to be ordered around, and neither do our kids. So it's tricky because there are actually so many things we need our kids to do: put their pants on, stop bothering their brother, you know,
right?
Brush their teeth, you know, as you were saying. So we have a lot of strategies in our book on how you can make kids feel more cooperative. My first go-to for little kids is to be playful. If you've got a 3- or 4-year-old and you need them to put their pants on, pick up that pair of pants and make a talk for the kids. "I'm feeling so empty here. I need a pair of legs in me." Very few little kids can resist a talking pair of pants. So being playful is one of my favorite strategies, especially for little kids, to get them to do things. I've worked with parents who are trying to get their kids to brush their teeth. And, you know, it doesn't help. The lecture about how if you don't keep your teeth clean, you're going to have cavities when you get older, it's just so abstract. No kid really gets it. And they kind of think, "I did it yesterday. Why do I have to do it again today?" So if you can think of any kind of wacky, fun game to play with your kids, I have to say that I have three kids of my own. They're all grown now, but they all resisted the toothbrushing thing when they were little. And so I started this game where, out of desperation, I said, you know what? I heard that all the zoo animals are missing and they're hiding in kids' teeth, in kids' mouths. Should we look in your mouth and see if they're there? Well, suddenly my son, who would refuse to open his mouth a moment ago, was opening it up saying, look, Mom, what do you see? And I'm like, ooh, I think I see a zebra. Hold on. Ah. I think there's a lion up there. You know, and every night he wanted to know what we were going to find. And I branched out from zoo animals to, I think, you remember Grandma couldn't find her glasses? I think they're in there. You know, so it just became a fun activity. And I have to say that a lot of parents say to me, like, who has the energy for this? Oh, my God. Right. Don't they have to learn that they just have to do it? Mm. And, you know, believe me, the kids, well, there's a lot that they will have to do. But anytime we can make any kind of activity more pleasant. I mean, I was just listening to Vince talk about picking up garbage. And if you had told me that you were going to get your 5 and your 7 and 5 year old picking up garbage and everybody's having fun, I think that's the way to do it. Right. You know?
Right. Just the playfulness, I think, takes the heat out of the situation. And you also talk about the importance of acknowledging the child's feelings in that moment. Tell us a little bit about that.
Absolutely. You know, let's say you're, we'll go back to the pants example. Let's say you're trying to get your pants on and you've made the pants talk and they say, no, no pants, no pants. Okay. Something must be going on. Rather than just focusing on what we want, what behavior we want, I like to ask the question, why? Why is this child saying no? And if we can think about what it feels like to be a kid, then we might have some guess as to what's going on. I have one of my kids has very sensitive legs. And so he actually didn't like to have certain kinds of pants certain kinds of material on his legs. And so if I pulled those out, he would say no. And I could say, oh, you don't like the feeling of those pants on your leg. It feels too scratchy. You know, kids want to be understood. They want us to know what's going on for them. So if a kid is resisting doing something that we really want them to do, you know, the example that comes to mind, what we have with COVID and kids getting sick and medicine, I've had a lot of parents who say, you know, my kid doesn't want to take their antibiotics. Let's just say, and I pretended to talk for the antibiotics. I said, you know, oh, the antibiotics is feeling like it wants a little, have a little journey down your throat. And they're like, no, no. You know, if those kinds of playful strategies don't work, then we want to go back and acknowledge, ugh, you really don't want to have to take this medicine. It tastes icky. If it were up to you, if it were up to you, you would only take medicine that tasted good. You know, I wish we could turn it into something that tastes like, you know, pizza or chocolate. Then it would be easier to take. In fact, I'm reminded of a story that somebody told me very recently about their teen who didn't want to go get a booster shot because he doesn't like needles. And the mom had told him, look, you know, just go get it over with. It's not that big a deal. Doesn't hurt that much. You know, you just do it. You have to do it for your health. Right.
Right.
And he was refusing to go. And then she told me she acknowledged his feelings. I would imagine she said something like, oh, the thought of voluntarily baring your arm and giving somebody, you're letting them stick a needle in you. It's just so unappealing. You don't want to do it. And she said, after she acknowledged his feelings, that's when he got in his car and drove to the clinic and got his booster.
Oh, that's, I mean, the advice is timeless. The advice is really timeless. It doesn't matter what age your kid is. Let me reintroduce the program. This is State of the Bay on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm your host, Grace Wan. This evening, we're discussing parenting strategies with Bay Area author and parent counselor, Julie King. Do you have a quiet child who just won't open up? Or do you have a kid who's battling with homework or refusing to do his or her chores? Give us your parenting questions and concerns. You can join us by calling 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or email us at stateofthebay@klw.org. You can find us on Twitter. We're at State of Bay. So, Julie, we were talking about strategies, and yours included being playful, acknowledging feelings. Another strategy that I thought in your book that I thought was so wise was just the quiet, silent acknowledgement. Instead of being like roped into the child's meltdown or defiance or whatever, merely saying, Tell me, why does that work?
You know, I call it the grunts and groans, the ums and ahs. And I'm going to make a generalization. I hope you don't mind. If I've heard a girlfriend talking on a cell phone with her friend, and I don't know what they're talking about, but I can hear her end of the conversation. And this is what it sounds like. Right. So I have no idea what they're talking about, but I can tell the emotional journey of that conversation just from her reaction. That's what those grunts and groans, that's what we're talking about when we say you can say, it shows our kids that we're really listening, that we get what they're saying, that we're following sort of the emotional tone of the message. So it's really helpful for people. Have you ever been in a car? I don't know if you have kids. I've done this.
Yes, I have been in a car.
With your kids.
Oh, yes.
And they're
yes.
talking. And
oh,
they're
yes.
talking and talking. And I've done this. They're telling me something, and I'm driving, and I'm thinking about dinner, and I'm going, And then they go, Mom, you're not listening. I think, I was caught.
Right? Yes. Yeah, that happens a lot.
Well, because, you know, the kids, they have a lot to say sometimes, and it's hard to keep up and have your own thoughts. Mm-hmm. But they want to know that we're listening. If I go, that happened too. What else? You know, I don't have to say much more than that. Then they know I'm listening. I get it. And that's very powerful. I had a teacher in one of my workshops. She was a preschool teacher, and she said she had this little boy who used to come running up to her all the time and tell her, you know, Pete said that I can't have a turn on the swing and that he's not going to be finished for a long time. And I don't like that. And she used to give him all kinds of advice. Well, why don't you go tell Pete that he can only, you know, ride for a few minutes and he has to give you a turn. And this was happening over and over. And she said, he just never stopped running up to her. And she kept giving him advice, but it didn't seem to be helping. And after she heard about this idea of acknowledging feelings with just a word or a sound, she started just giving him the ums and ahs. Oh, really? Oh, And she said he was perfectly satisfied with that response. Mm. He didn't need advice. He just wanted somebody to know that he was a little frustrated because he couldn't get on the slide or he couldn't get his turn on the swing yet. And then he would run off and play again.
Oh, well, you have some other advice, some of which it's interesting. It may be a little bit controversial, and it's your take on punishment. You don't recommend it. And tell me, why isn't punishment the way to go when it comes to kids less than stellar behavior?
Well, the problem with punishment is just not as effective as some of the other strategies we have. Let's say that you're a little kid and you have a new baby brother and you hate that I'm spending so much time with the baby. So you pinch the baby, right? Now, if I send you to the corner to punish you, how do you feel about the baby now? Do you feel like, oh, well, that's that baby, he's part of the family. I really should be treating him better. Mm. Or do you feel like, I hate the baby, now he gets me in trouble and he's still taking more of my mother's attention? Mm-hmm. So it may be just as likely that that kid is not going to pinch the baby when mother's not around, when she can see it, but he's more likely to when mother's not around. So sometimes punishment can, you know, they call it extinguishing the behavior, but it can also create what I would call collateral damage. You know, kids trying to sneak around when they won't get caught. I often ask people in my workshops what they remember about being punished. And they typically remember what the punishment was, but they often don't remember what the punishment was for. Right. And that's pretty telling. You know, that's not the message. That's not the lesson we want them to learn. And then there's the dad I had in one of my groups who said he had a very punitive mother. And so he got revenge on her. He accidentally, on purpose, broke her favorite vase when she couldn't figure out who it was. He never let her know it was him. You know, he found a way to get back at her. And punishment can incite those feelings of revenge, those desires to get back at the adult who's who's done this to us? Like, why are they hurting us? Mm-hmm.
Well, what's the alternative then? I mean, let's say your child is really poorly behaved and hits another kid or is not kind to an animal. I mean, there must be something that we should do. We can't just let the behavior go unaddressed,
yes.
Right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. This is not a permissive approach. Mm-hmm. You know, if that baby got pinched, I'm moving that child away. I'm picking up the baby and comforting the baby, of course, first, because baby got hurt. But I'm not going to, and I'm going to separate them. I'm going to make sure that can't happen again. I'm going to take action. We call it taking action without insult. I'm going to take action to protect the baby, mm-hmm. to protect myself from having mm-hmm. to protect the baby. Right. But it's not going to stop there. If a child, let's just go back to that example. If a child is really resentful of that baby, I'm going to talk to that child later about what's going on for that child. You don't like it when I have to spend so much time with the baby. You'd like to have some attention too. What can we do? Can you tell me when you need a hug? Can you come and tell me when you feel like you don't want me to be with the baby? Now, it's not that I'm going to say, oh, well, I'll just toss the baby out the window and spend time with you. But being able to acknowledge that that's what's going on for a child, I think sometimes we're a little hesitant to talk to our older child when they feel jealousy or resentment because we're afraid that's going to grow the feeling. Mm-hmm. But the reality is that child's going to feel understood. They're going to feel like, oh, okay, she understands. She gets how I feel. And we're going to look for some things that we can do to make it feel like you're getting some of the attention you need.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're getting some listener questions. We've got Bo. He's the father of 12 and 14-year-old girls, and he asks, what's your advice for confronting a tween who has just been caught in a lie? How do you alter your response for a small lie and a big lie?
Can we find out what this is about? What kind of liar?
I think that's just the
it's that's a, it?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, so because it's so hard if we don't know what it is. Kids lie for a number of reasons. You know, sometimes they lie because they're embarrassed. Sometimes they lie because they want something that they know they're not supposed to have. So that's what I would be wanting to get at. Mm-hmm. If I know that they have lied, I don't want to, quote unquote, catch them in a lie, like prove to them, oh, did you tell me that you were going to go over to so-and-so's house and you didn't? Now, you know, be honest, like let's, because I know you didn't. We don't have to do that. We can just say, I know you wanted to go to your friend's house and I said no, and you really didn't like that. And I heard that you went anyway. We need to talk about this because I need to know that I can rely on you when you say you're not going to go, that you're not going to go. I guess I'm thinking about a mom who I worked with who had a teen who wanted to borrow the car, and she knew there was some parties going on. This was in Marin. And she said, you can borrow the car, but you can't go to these parties. Well, guess what? He went to the parties anyway, and he didn't tell her, but she found out from somebody else. Right. And she called me up and she says, well, I know I'm not supposed to punish him, but doesn't he have to have some sort of consequence? And I said, you know what the consequence is when he doesn't follow through with, and he's not a person of his word, so to speak. I said, what happens is you learn that you can't trust him when he says he won't go, and mm-hmm. he goes anyway. And so you're going to protect yourself, and you're going to say, the next time he wants to borrow the car, I can't do that. I need to know that you won't be driving over to that party. And if I give you the, what I learned is when I gave you the car, you did it anyway. Mm-hmm. That won't be the end of the discussion, but right. that's where I'm going to start.
Well, it seems like, I mean, doesn't the kid perceive that, though, as a form of punishment? You didn't let me have the car when I wanted to have the car?
Ah, that's a good question. So people often ask me, well, what do we mean by punishment? Mm-hmm. What I mean is I'm intentionally imposing suffering on a child in order to change their behavior, mm-hmm. right? So it is true that the language I use when I say, I can't let you take the car, I'd be too worried that you're going to, you know, speed or go to the party that you're not supposed to. And so I'm doing it to protect you and to protect myself. I'm not doing it to make you suffer. Now, kids aren't going to like it, mm-hmm. but we're going to have to look for a way to rebuild trust, you know, because we don't want to be there forever. Okay. But the more that we can frame it as, this is why I'm doing it, not because I want you to be stuck at home all day and be miserable. But I learned that I can't just hand them to you and expect you to follow the rules. So I think kids can make that distinction, and that's an important distinction.
Well, we have Julie King here with us answering parenting questions and giving us good advice on how to get through a pandemic with kids. This is State of the Bay on Local Public Radio 91.7 KALW San Francisco Bay Area. And I'm your host, Grace Wan. If you have a parenting question, a concern, an issue that you want to share, you can give us a call. We're at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org or find us on Twitter. We're at State of Bay. So, Julie, another on the opposite side of punishment is something that can be equally tricky. Doesn't sound like it can be, but it is praise and how you, I mean, what praise means for kids these days and how praise can be a little bit pernicious, like not good for kids. So tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah. I like to do a try it on yourself exercise, as you've noticed.
Yeah.
So that we can see what it feels like. So, Grace, imagine I said to you in the course of this interview, you know, you are the most perfect interviewer I've ever had. You just ask the best questions. Your follow-up is so thoughtful, right?
You're already my favorite guest. I mean, let me tell you, Julie King, you are the most favorite guest I've ever had.
You never say the wrong thing. It's always right on point. Now, you might like it, but you also might hesitate to ever interview me again because it's a lot of pressure to live up to perfection, right? So, and you might also think, is she being sincere? Is she just trying to, you know, butter me up for something?
Right.
What does she want from me? So, you know, what if I said instead to you, you know, I really appreciate the follow-up questions you asked me in that conversation with punishment. It really made me think more deeply about the subject. And I think it was really helpful to your listeners to understand the distinction between taking action and punishment. So what's that now, you know, I really mean what I say. I'm being very specific.
Mm-hmm.
I'm describing what you did rather than judging it. Right. And so what typically happens is you think to yourself when you got praised that way, I did do that. Oh, yeah, I did ask that follow-up question. That was pretty good. Yeah, I can ask some pretty good questions. So you kind of praise yourself. So this style of praise, I think of it as describing what a child has done, what effort they have put into something, what progress they've made, what effect they've had on others. Instead of telling a child, you're such a kind little girl, you're so nice to your friends, which some kids will think to themselves, well, I'm not always, you know, there was that time I wouldn't share my cookies with her, right? But if we describe specifically, oh, you saw your friend, she dropped her crackers in the sand and she couldn't eat them and she was crying and you went and shared your crackers with her. I could see how much she appreciated that. Did you see her smiling? And she felt so relieved that she had something to eat. Now that's something we can't take away from a child. If we say you're such a good girl, the next time she does something bad, you know, that descriptor is gone.
I think what I'm noticing in the way you're offering the advice is it's very specific and it's pretty grounded. I mean, I can imagine that, you know, you're telling us to just take a deep breath before we, you know, be reactive and actually kind of be proactive and think calmly about what it is that we want to say to the kids. And almost like we're treating our kids not like kids, but like real thinking human beings.
Yes, I couldn't say it better. Yes, kids want to be appreciated for who they are. They want to have a say in what they do. Yeah, it's a very respectful way of parenting.
Right. Well, Jill in Marin writes, when kids are fighting and you clearly side with one child over the other, what do you do?
Well, I don't recommend that you side with one or the other. Sometimes parents will sometimes say to me, the kids come and I'm always trying to figure out who started it. And I say to the parents, I know who started it. Every time, you know who started it? You started it because you had both of them.
Yeah.
So, you know, what we can do best to be helpful for our kids when they're fighting is to not take sides, is to be the mediator. I think our goal for our kids is for them to learn how to resolve conflicts, but we're not born knowing how to do that. So as a parent, what I can do is I can listen to both sides. I can say to one child, oh, so you wanted to listen to some loud rock music because it gets you energized and gets you ready to do your homework. And you feel like you need something calming because you've been around people all day and it's been noisy and you need something quieter and it's driving you crazy, all that sound and noise. Huh. What could we do? This is a problem. We have one person who wants loud music and one person who wants calm music. And we only have one system. Like, what can we do? So I'm going to acknowledge what each child wants, how each child's feeling. And then I'm going to describe the problem without resolving it, without offering a solution. And then this is the hardest thing for the parent, is to stop and wait and let them think about it. And so, you know, I did this with my kids a lot. I'm trying to think of a good example for you. I'll give you an example from my kids' lives when they were younger. So my two boys loved to play games on the computer. And when they were little, we had one computer for the whole family. I know that is just not what people do anymore. Right? So I'm aging
already
myself.
I see a lot of conflict, Julie.
Right? Yes. There was a lot. Right? And so there was a day when Rashi sat down at the computer for his allotted half an hour of playtime, and he was playing his computer game and he had to go to the bathroom. So he paused his game and he went to the bathroom, and Asher walked by, saw the computer was not being used, and sat down, closed out Rashi's game and started playing. And then Rashi came out of the bathroom. Well, you can probably imagine the eruption that happened. Mm. I was still playing. You closed me out. And he was really upset. And Asher said, I didn't know you were playing. And he said, yes, you did. So I kind of dragged them away from the computer. That was my first step, was let's take them away from the object that's in contention. And I first had to just acknowledge, I started with Rashi because he was the more unhinged, like, oh, you were in the middle of playing and it got closed out. And I acknowledged Asher's feelings. And you didn't know. Right? And then I said, what could we do? Something like this could happen again. And the first suggestion that Rashi said was, well, Asher should have to go and find me and see if I'm still playing. And if I'm in the bathroom, he should find me and ask me. And Asher said, well, that's ridiculous. I can't go running around always. It's not fair that I would have to ask. And I won't bore you with all the details, but I eventually said, well, you know, what else could we do? And Asher said, Rashi has to put a sign on the computer saying I'm in the middle of playing. And Rashi said, you can't do that because I have to go to the bathroom and I don't have time to write a note. And Asher said, well, why don't we write a note ahead of time? And Rashi said, okay. And that was the solution, which if I had come up with it, wouldn't have worked. But when they came up with it.
Well, again, it's about giving the kids some autonomy in the decision making and how to resolve the situation. It seems like. Well, I wanted to just ask you about the pandemic. I mean, this morning I got a story in the New York Times sent to me three times, and the story is about women in Massachusetts who meet on a football field and primal scream because the last 2 years have been so rough on parenting for parents. And I wondered, you know, your book is about how to talk so that kids will listen to you, but what advice do you have for parents out there who really have been suffering? You know, their kids have been home a lot more. The world is not the same as it used to be. And maybe parents' levels of patience aren't what they used to be, because a lot of what your approach requires is a little bit of patience. So what advice do you have for parents in a pandemic, Julie?
Well, I think the first thing is we have to be kind to ourselves, and we have to lower our expectations, because we are asking parents to do really the impossible. To be, you know, so many parents are juggling kids at home with school, Zoom school, trying to work from home, trying to do everything. And I think we have to lower our expectations of ourselves, and we have to be kind to ourselves, and we have to recognize that sometimes I don't have the patience. I had a dad who called me. He said, I just got so angry with my daughter and it scared me. And, you know, and I yelled at her, and I don't want to be yelling at her. And I said, you know, there's yelling harsh language, and then there's yelling, I'm so frustrated. I can't even think what to say. Yeah. And that's just not as damaging. You know, I think we can acknowledge our own feelings. I've been talking a lot about acknowledging a child's feelings, but it can be really helpful to say, I feel overwhelmed. I feel like I can't do this anymore. I'm exhausted. I'm hungry. I need help.
Right.
and saying it out loud, even if we don't have another adult to tag team with. I mean, that's the ideal. But just being able to say it and acknowledge it for ourselves can be enormously helpful.
Right. Well, we have one last question, which I think is a very common question for parents. Is a dad writes in, how do you handle talk back when you're raising a concern with your kid? What's the best practice when you're facing that kind of resistance?
Well, I like to reframe what talk back is. The first time that somebody asked me this question, I actually had to ask them what they meant when they said, my kid is talking back. Because the expectation was that if I tell him to do something, he should do it without question. And I would like to suggest that, yeah, sometimes we want that, but sometimes we don't. Right? If your child is always doing what they're told and they grow up and their friends tell them, smoke this, taste this, eat that, you know, go with me, don't tell your parents. We actually want them to talk back, at least in their own minds, and think, that's not for me. That doesn't make sense for me. So rather than trying to quote unquote end the talk back, let's find out what is it that they're talking back about. And can we acknowledge that they don't like our decisions, even if we're not going to change them? We can acknowledge that they would rather not have to stop what they're doing and you know, do their chores now or whatever it is that we're asking them to do. So I would actually do a reframe about the talk back.
Mm-hmm. Well, this has been all incredibly good advice. And just listening to you, I wish you had been my mom, although I have a great mother. She was really good. Just mom, if you're listening, I thought you did a great job. But it's been great advice for our listeners. And we're so pleased that you could join us, Julie King.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
You can find Julie and Joanna's book, How to Talk When Kids Won't Listen, anywhere books are sold. You can also find a link to Julie's website for counseling, workshops, and lectures, as well as links to her app on the State of the Bay page at klw.org. Thanks again, Julie King.
Thank you.
Coming up after the break, what conversations have you overheard while on the streets and the coffee shops of San Francisco? The Instagram account Overhood San Francisco takes eavesdropping to an all-new heights by cataloging some of the more hilarious exchanges that take place between Bay Area residents. Up next, we'll have Ethan Elkind's interview with Emily Bernstein, the head of content at Overhood. Coming up next, we've got the interview with Ethan Elkind. He's interviewing Emily Bernstein from Overheard. And that interview is up next.
Emily, welcome to State of the Bay. Do you mind describing just what Overheard San Francisco is for our listeners who may not already be familiar with the social media account?
Yes. Hi. Thanks for having me. Overheard San Francisco is part of the Overheard brand of city accounts, which actually started with Overheard LA and New York. So we post very simple yet ridiculous, hilarious, painfully relatable things heard all around the Bay Area, all submitted by our followers. So. We do have original content on stories and reels, but the quotes are just the like heart and soul of what we do. It's a very simple laugh in the middle of your newsfeed.
And how did all this get started?
We launched Overheard San Francisco in 2018, but actually in 2015, LA and New York were launched by our founder, Jesse Margolis. He actually was, I believe, sitting in Air One in Los Angeles, there's no Air One in the Bay Area, but I would say it's equivalent to, it's like Whole Foods on steroids. It's like the most crunchy, high-end store you can be in. And he was sitting there listening to people talking. And I think somebody just said the most ridiculous thing he'd ever heard, and he had to write it down. He started posting them on Instagram, and it just took off. It became this like viral phenomenon. And so New York started shortly after that. And then San Francisco. And now we also have London, and we just launched Austin as well, which ironically, Austin is just a lot of people that left the Bay Area and LA and moved to Austin. So
you could argue you're basically just satirizing Bay Area culture as it disperses to other cities.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
And so given that there are other of these Overheard accounts in other cities, what is unique that you found about San Francisco?
Well, Overheard San Francisco is obviously my favorite of the accounts. It's a lot of tech, which you would expect. You know, tech is just such a huge part of life here. There are the people that work in tech and they talk about tech. And there are also the people that don't work in tech necessarily, but they're talking about it and trying to make sense of it. And so they're walking around like, what is Ethereum? You know, who's speaking Java? And then there's the actual people using tech terminology in everyday life, which is like someone on a date, for example, saying, I'm a product manager. It's my job to know if we're compatible. Like, of course you hear that. You have to send that in. That is so ridiculously San Francisco. And you just won't hear that anywhere else. But then to go with that, there's the other side of San Francisco, the old San Francisco, if you will. It's the counterculture and the holistic side and the spiritual side. So it has this contrast of kind of that crunchier woo side of San Francisco with the Google bus bros. And I think it creates a really interesting mix of people and what they're saying like in earnest too. So,
well, I was going to ask about the process. How do you find out about these overheard statements and conversations? What's the process for vetting them? How does that all work?
They're all submitted. There's a ton of submissions coming in all the time. Sometimes there's actually been a few occasions where something is said in public, like in a Target, and multiple people have submitted it. So it's like, I know that two different people standing in that line sent it in. As far as vetting, we have to be really rigorous with vetting this stuff because, you know, I want to make sure it's real and was said in earnest. And, you know, having done this for 4 years, I can really instantly tell if somebody is making something up or trying to be funny, because really we don't want people who are trying to be funny and make jokes. You know, we want the real thing that is said so truly and naturally that is so funny to hear, but it actually is nobody's trying to be funny at all in that moment. So that's, I think, the really big thing with the vetting is this person, you know, trying to be funny and trying to get a laugh, or is this person truly saying this thing to their date across the table? And it is so funny that the world just needs to know that this was said. So, we send legal releases with our quotes that kind of deters, people just sending random stuff. And I often will cross-reference like Reddit and Twitter if something sounds a little too far-fetched, and, you know, make sure that it doesn't exist elsewhere on the internet.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and if people know that they're not legitimate or don't seem legitimate, they're not going to want to keep reading. But I'd love to hear some examples. I'm just curious, what really stands out to you as like something that could only be said in San Francisco?
There's a lot of good ones. But I think a recent one that comes to mind was somebody saying, sorry, I'm late. I had an hour-long session with my energy worker. And it's like, Reiki or PG&E? I was like, oh, Reiki. So there's another one from Halloween. I think one of my favorites of all time, that was just somebody saying, Halloween in San Francisco is so anticlimactic. I see a man in a full-body cheetah suit unicycling down Market every Tuesday. I used to work off Market. I have seen this also. I think there's a weirdness to San Francisco that is just so loved, like a lovable weirdness that comes across in so many of these quotes that I think, you know, somebody in LA might just shrug and say, oh, that's weird. But somebody in San Francisco is, we are so proud of that man in the cheetah suit unicycling down Market. That's our city.
And I think we've probably all seen that man in the cheetah suit. So yeah, people can definitely.
Lots of nudity too. We get a ton of quotes about naked people everywhere.
I'm sure that's good fodder for this account, I'm sure. So have things changed since COVID came about? Have you noticed that submissions have changed? I mean, people aren't outside as much, right? Or they're maybe not as social to overhear crazy comments.
Yeah, it's an interesting shift. There's less of strangers interacting with each other in public. Sadly, you know, San Francisco is crowded. It's a place where people walk really close to each other and share spaces, and the tech campuses. Now everybody's working from home. So we lost some of the stranger interactions. When COVID first hit, we started getting a lot of Zoom submissions and posting those. And that was just kind of a fun way to pivot and get those conversations, you know, on the account, but we're all inside kind of losing our minds. And that's kind of what's special about it is we're reflecting content back that's live. It's what culture is going through. It's what the city is going through. So, you know, there was a time where all anyone could talk about was banana bread and doing puzzles. And so that's what's on the account. And it's kind of this time capsule of what we went through in a, you know, ongoing pandemic.
I also want to ask you if you've thought about or have you put in place efforts to try to increase the diversity of communities and cultures that, you know, you end up kind of lampooning through these overheard remarks and comments?
One of the things I wish we could improve and we're kind of constantly working on is that we are satirizing a certain bubble. And by doing that, we inevitably find ourselves in that bubble. So there's an acknowledgement that I know there's so much more to San Francisco in terms of voices and diversity than what we have on the account. And at the same time, we're often poking fun at people. So the bubble is what everyone wants to poke fun at is, you know, the marina people or what have you. And we never want to punch down. So it's an interesting balance of how do we include more diverse perspectives and voices on the account, while never punching down, but being genuinely funny.
So Emily, can you tell me about how this website translates into real life interactions with people?
For me, my absolute favorite part of this account is actually connecting people off Instagram. My best example of that is a few years ago, I don't know, who knows, 2020 has been like 3 years, but we started doing misconnections where, you know, like old school Craigslist, somebody would write in and say, I saw this person over here, or we bumped into each other, we said this to each other. And I just took the reins in the Instagram stories and we went on like a wild goose chase looking for this person, and people are submitting help and somebody says, oh, my roommate has a dog that looks like this and this might be the guy. And we've connected two couples successfully this way. One of them like went on dates and we, you know, we sent them to dinner. They sent us pictures. It was adorable. And that type of stuff just is so cool. I'm just a facilitator, but they're the ones connecting on this account. Early in the lockdown, when everything was kind of bleak, there was somebody rollerblading down Haight Street in bell bottoms. And she was like, I'm social discoing. And it just like lit everybody up. And we, you know, we posted it because it was just so sweet and fun. And then we found the girl who did it. And she made all these friends and got all this following from it. So I hope she's still rollerblading around the city somewhere. That's just the type of stuff that makes me happy.
Great. Well, Emily Bernstein from Overheard San Francisco, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
All of our guests. Well, that's State of the Bay this week. We want to thank all of our guests and listeners this evening for being part of the conversation. For more information about this and other State of the Bay shows, visit the State of the Bay page on kalw.org. And if you have any questions or comments about anything you heard tonight, let us know. You can email us anytime at stateofthebay@kalw.org. Next Monday, we'll discuss state and local efforts to regulate ghost guns. And plus, you'll hear my interview with artist Eric Stoller. He's the creator of the bubble boat that you might see bobbing in the water off Chrissy Field, and he's actually invited me to be on it. I'm a little bit nervous. Tonight's show was produced by Jillian Emblad and Kendrick Lang. It was engineered by David Kwan, and David LaTulipe was our board operator. Thanks, everyone. Have a good night. Thanks for listening, and good luck with the parenting.